Hello and welcome back to the Rust Belt Risters podcast. My name is Andrew Roman. In this episode, I want to build a framework for thinking about the relative successes and failures of the Pittsburgh Penguins this past season. This will likely be the first of several podcasts that features this type of framework for understanding players. Quality versus depth is one of the age-old questions in sports. Essentially, what I'm concerned with in this episode is, if every team could allot a certain amount of quality points, just magical beans of quality, to their team, would it be better to spend those points over many different players, or would it be better to concentrate them in a few ultra-talented players? This is quite literally a type of game theory, and we will get into that in just a moment. This concept of allocating our, you know, magical beans of talent or quality or whatever you want to call them is especially hard to puzzle out in a sport like hockey, and even more specifically within the NHL, where there is a hard salary cap that's in place. Best way to balance these dimensions has been handled differently by different teams. Some teams, such as the Boston Bruins or Ottawa Senators, have opted to trade away their unique elite talented players in order to acquire, you know, more depth, or in other words, kind of like the perception that while they may not have that one elite player any longer, they now have several players who offer more quality than they previously had and are raising the talent floor on the team in a different sort of way. You know, our very own Pittsburgh Penguins kind of represent the opposite tact. The team has been content to, you know, resist the fan and pundit pressure to trade away generational talents like Evgeny Malkin and Chris Letang, at least so far, anyway, while knowing that the cost of keeping the Malkin and Letangs of the world kind of reduce the number of these fabled points that they're able to spread throughout the rest of the lineup. In order to understand the difference between this kind of elite talent notion versus more evenly distributed talent, I want to point out the concept of something called strong link versus weak link games. This is a concept that I first learned of in a book called The Numbers Game, Why Everything You Know About Soccer Is Wrong. It was written by Chris Anderson and David Sally. And it is the theme for this episode and potentially more moving forward. The theory behind these types of strong link versus weak link games is, I think, fairly straightforward. A strong link game is one where the team with the singular best player will usually win, while a weak link game is one in which the team without the worst player usually wins. Not to kind of overindulge this point, but when you are looking at the framework for like a weak link versus a strong link game, consider these kind of examples. So soccer is the definition of a weak link sport. It's intrinsically low scoring game played on a large playing surface with a large number of players involved in the game. Even ideally speaking, an elite game-changing striker can only probably receive a handful of touches per game, and arguably, if they are doing their job correctly, they'll barely control the ball for more than a few seconds in any one game. As such, it is in the best interest of soccer teams to spend to upgrade weaker players, and to spend on goal prevention, as opposed to spending on superstars and strongling players. Not that that's often what they do. You know, when you look at kind of soccer transfers, they're just absolutely insane, but we can't fault them for that, making that kind of decision. We do see this as an emerging theme in soccer, though, with players such as Virgil van Dijk or N'Golo Kanté valued for the defensive presence that they offer. And we're starting to see that, you know, defensive midfielders or center backs are now actually starting to earn transfer fees on par with the attacking midfielders and strikers of the game. Basketball is the epitome of a strong link sport. It's high scoring, it features fewer players within the game playing surface, and each team is guaranteed a whole bunch of possessions. As such, you know, typically a unique elite talent can carry his or her team in a disproportionate way. You can make a serious case that a soccer team may be unable to put their strongest link player in a position to win the game, but typically the same cannot be said for a basketball team. I mean, how often do you not see Steph Curry or LeBron James or any other, you know, basketball superstar not have that final touch in a game when they're trying to win or force overtime or whatever the case may be? So the question then is, where does hockey fit into this? It certainly is a sport that defies an easy definition. On one hand, top players at the top level only play between, you know, probably one third to one half of the game, which would suggest that it's more of a weak link type of sport where you need to have good depth throughout the lineup. But the relatively limited number of players in the game also suggests that when those star players are on the ice, the play must and does go through them, which is more evidence for strong link theory. Well, I don't know if the theory is fully supported right now. The common logic within hockey writing communities, stats communities, is that hockey ultimately is a strong link sport. Alex Novet at Hockey Graphs has offered the following pieces of evidence for this. The first is that, according to MoneyPuck, at MoneyPuck on Twitter, and an analyst for the Florida Panthers, contending teams have at least one elite player. In other words, they have at least one unquestioned strong link on which the team depends an inordinate amount. Secondly, when we look at a catch-all statistic for quality, such as Don't Tell Me About Hart's construction of WAR, or wins above replacement, there is no significant relationship between the best player and the worst player on one team. So what that kind of tells us is that there is nothing that says that having good players also means a team must carry some bad ones to balance it out. I mean, so in other words, there really is no magical bean for quality points that teams only have a set number that they can distribute amongst their lineup. Really good teams tend to have good depth as well. But it's also true, however, that there is a weak correlation between the best player's WAR score and team points. So, in other words, for that, when a team has one or more great players, the likelihood of them making the playoffs is also increasing. This relationship also works with goal differential, which is interesting because many people don't like team points as it's a kind of flawed measure because of the way that the NHL scores most games. There's so many three-point games, but this also occurs with goal differential. I've done some of my own digging into trying to assess quality within a team and trying to figure out strong links versus weak links and the like. I did some analyses in which I tabulated a player's average time on ice plus their scoring, plus their raw possession metrics per game played, which kind of gave me this raw aggregate score of if I thought they were a quality player or not. And then I measured that, correlated that against team success. Ultimately, what I found with these correlation analyses that I ran was that while there is something there, it's a significant relationship, the actual effect itself was trivial. There was nothing to be gleaned. It was just random points of data all over the place, which basically tells us that there's not really a meaningful difference between, you know, having a really strong second and third line versus the teams that just simply load up their top line and go out and beat the other team on the strength of their top end talent. So while I admit that my particular method is fairly crude, it's not as elegant as many of the, you know, better statisticians out there, what all of this information does tell us is that when controlling for what we can, hockey is a strong link sport. Good players win games by scoring points. Bad players don't inherently limit a team's ability to win. You know, I think as much as anything, they just don't see the ice enough to make it matter. By this point, you're probably saying to yourself, that sounds great. This should be pretty simple. You know, now that we know that there's nothing wrong with carrying a bad player or two, it should be pretty simple to take all of those magical bean quality points and, you know, kind of turn them into something real. And that something real being, you know, actual player contracts. Of course, that's basically where the problems actually start. I talked about controlling for what we can in the findings that I talked about earlier from Alex Novet, but that's easier said than done. To go back to his work, when you apply a regression analysis to the variables measured, Novet found an R-squared value of 0.14. Or in other words, these results really only explain 14% of the variance in the relationship. That isn't really very much. Basically stated another way, this suggests that a tool like strong link theory is only about 15% predictable, or kind of phrased even another different way, it basically means that we don't understand about 85% of what goes into making a successful hockey team based on just strong versus weak link theory. Realistically speaking, though, the fact that we know that this explains anything at all tells us something pretty significant. And all of that unknown variance can probably be summed up in a few different ways. Firstly, GMs are inherently bad at evaluating players and don't pay them commensurate to their value. We're definitely going to dig into this pretty deeply in the next couple weeks, but that's just, you know, a pretty obvious essential thing to know. Additionally, injuries and aging curves are a real thing, and they carry a real cost in asset allocation. But perhaps the biggest challenge to this model is still ultimately just pure random puck luck. Now that I've gone ahead and laid out the framework for why I think that strong link theory is a good way to look at evaluating hockey talent, I will go ahead and end this episode. And so that way, next week, we can go ahead and apply some weak and strong designations to the players on the current Penguins roster. In case you don't remember, my name is Andrew Roman. This has been the Rust Belt Risters podcast. If you like this show, please leave a rating on iTunes to help others discover the show. You can also find this show on the ReggiesHousePodcasts.com website, along with Greedo Shot First, which is a show that I put on with my friend Connor Arlette about all things Star Wars, as well as the Games and App podcast, hosted by Brandon Carnahan and Andrew Fiuk. They delve into the world of video games and produce some honest, heartfelt, sincere reviews of games, both the latest and the greatest. So, as I said last week, it's a great day for hockey, so let's go enjoy it. Okay, I'm back. It took me exactly zero episodes to break my promise of only doing one topic per episode, but that was certainly before the Phil Kessel to Minnesota Wild rumors started spiraling out of control. If you're not familiar with the story, I guess my real short rundown of it is this. Around Thursday or Friday of last week, that would be like May 23rd, 24th, people started to report that the Penguins and Minnesota Wild were working on a trade that focused on Phil Kessel going to Minnesota in exchange for Jason Zucker. At one point, it was also reported that the trade could include Jack Johnson and Victor Rask exchanging teams, but it has now come out, however, that Phil, who does have a limited no-trade clause, I believe that it's structured such that he has submitted 8 teams that he does not need to give his approval to, accept a trade to, but otherwise the Penguins do need him to waive the clause in order to make a trade happen. And apparently he was unwilling to waive the clause to go to Minnesota for reasons that I probably don't really need to enumerate here, beyond saying that Minnesota is a bad team and I don't blame him. The timing for this Kessel news is actually fairly interesting, and it does dovetail nicely with the episode that I just released just moments prior to this, insofar as we're talking about a player with elite talent, and we're kind of discussing that, you know, quantity versus quality dichotomy within the sport of hockey. Now, there is an old saying that to me seems to be fairly specific to hockey. I'm actually not sure if it is, but whoever trades for the best player in a trade wins that trade. And if you've paid attention to what I've been talking about in the last handful of minutes, you can see that perhaps surprisingly, this is supported by the data. This is actually an old hockey aphorism that they got right. I don't think I really need to tell you that Phil Kessel is an immensely talented hockey player and that he would be the best player involved in such a trade as what we just detailed. His offensive output is elite, and it's remained elite despite the fact that he's probably starting down the backside of his career aging curve. It's also true, however, and I was planning to spend a lot of time on this like next week, that Phil is not the quintessential strong link player. His offense is elite, but when you compare him in a war type of capacity where you're looking at both offensive outputs and defensive outputs, like his defense is seriously so bad as to minimize his overall effectiveness when measured based on that type of criteria. So with that explanation out of the way, I guess I will add that I do agree in principle with the notion from the popular media that the Penguins are unlikely to win a trade involving Phil. I don't know that I agree with them in the same way. You know, I think a lot of sensational media believe that, well, now Phil has expressed his displeasure. He's going to be hard to work with. He's not going to be motivated to accept a trade to any team that's not on his list. He's probably going to update his list and, you know, only list division rivals or Eastern Conference powers like Tampa and Boston. You know, ultimately, to me, it's just hard to win a trade when you're giving up the best player. Now, as far as the actual logistics of a trade involving Phil, I have to say, I actually don't mind something that looks kind of similar to a Kessel-Zucker type of deal. I mean, not to get kind of into the stats world too much, but when we do look at the actual war scores for both players last year, I mean, Zucker was far superior in that regard. Now, I mean, part of that is war is a score that's, you know, calculated against your own teammates, and Phil obviously plays on a much better team than the Wild currently. But Zucker was one of the most productive members, at least in terms of a war score, on the Wild, while Phil was really right in the middle of the pack on the Penguins. I mean, that kind of goes to my earlier point that Phil is a phenomenally offensively gifted player. But he does, for one thing, score a lot of points on the power play. And secondly, his defensive output is, you know, it hurts his score. He has a negative D war score, you know, whereas when we look at a player like Zucker, he was positive in both ends of the rink, which, you know, is not nothing. So I guess my major takeaway is this. I don't know that it's a great idea to trade Phil, but I don't know that it's a bad idea to trade Phil. I think the reality is his offensive productivity is a consequence of the power play, and it's a power play that really runs through him, but it's also an extremely prolific power play that you can't replicate the type of offense that he provides. And even looking at a player like Jason Zucker, I hate when teams or GMs or whomever it may be try to project what they believe a player is going to be capable of doing in their system. I think it's much more prudent to just kind of look at what they actually are right now and decide if that will help your team in any discernible way. Now, you know, a defensively responsible player who can still pot 25 goals, you know, maybe he will get a little bit of a boost and become a, you know, high 20s scorer consistently with a team like the Penguins playing with Malkin or Crosby. But you can never really assume that that's going to be the case. I mean, genuinely, there's only one example that I can actually think of in terms of like the Crosby-Malkin era of guys who were absolute anomalies in their time with the Penguins, and that would be James Neal. You know, certainly his offense in Pittsburgh was completely on a different level compared to what we saw in Dallas, in Nashville, in Vegas, and obviously things seem to really be coming off the rails a little bit for Neal up in Calgary. So the only other caveat that I'll really add to that is the only thing I wouldn't like about a player such as Jason Zucker is that he is 27. That's not really that far removed from a 31-year-old Phil Kessel, especially because, as I discussed earlier, you know, I believe that Phil, he kind of has a certain survivorship bias that a lot of players don't. Whereas a guy like Zucker, who's been a good, you know, kind of quintessential middle six forward for most of his career, doesn't necessarily project as one of those guys who's going to age real well. So with that said, you know, if I'm Jim Rutherford and I can find somebody that is very similar to Jason Zucker but might be 22, 23, 24, I'm actually pretty interested in that type of move, especially because you presume that a player in that age group probably isn't getting paid even as much as a guy like Zucker. And, you know, that might even open up the Penguins to actually be able to make a run at an impact player in free agency that maybe we're not thinking about right now. So that's just kind of, I guess, my general takeaway involving the news about Phil. You know, I think the reality is fans might as well get used to it. I don't see a scenario where, now that we know how adamant Rutherford is about trading him, that it's going to be a long time before he gets traded. If it does happen, we'll certainly get into a longer discussion of it then. And I guess in just kind of closing commentary, I'll just say, hey, Phil, thanks for those two Stanley Cups.